This session is on Zen cones. The circle that I have drawn on the board it's meant to be a circle. Let's pretend that's a circle. It's fine. It doesn't have to be a perfect circle. The circle is to give you
sufficient for engineering purposes.
An appreciation. To appreciate the starting point, the circle over here is a Buddhist symbol, and what the circle does is it doesn't surround the inner area; it surrounds everything else by being a nice, appreciable little circle. So a lot of the Zen cones have ideas where they try and get you to think differently or appreciate, like, the simplicity of a circle, but in a different way, and put yourself in a different place in order to understand that. In order to understand Zen cones, there's a little bit of background in terms of the culture that they developed in that needs to be understood, or else you don't really get some of them, and there's some bad translation things that happen, which makes it even harder to get them. And there's some transition between Chinese and Japanese, which makes it even more confusing sometimes. But having said that, the first thing I want to mention is that people studied Zen cones, like one 2-sentence long cone, for like a year or two, and they would meditate daily on a cone. So as much as we have like half an hour, we got this, guys. Trust me.
K-O-A-N. Right.
We're not going to get the full insight in like half an hour, but we might get something. So the next thing I want to mention is something from the book A Mind for Numbers. And the book talks about focused and diffuse thinking. So if you are, say, following multiplication, you can do it stepwise. You know, you understand how to do that. And that's a very focused sort of, you know, if you think of system one and two, it's more like a system two thing. You can focus very sharply on it. The other option is to be kind of diffuse about what you're doing. And this is very important in mathematics and physics and all that, that sometimes you just need to think for a second of the whole problem at once and kind of step back and broadly imagine the concept. And then sometimes things click a bit more. Most of Zen cones happen in diffuse thinking. If you focus too hard on it, you will miss it. You will like be too busy trying to work out what the words are and what they mean, and like miss the fact that it's this broad. You're searching for something else completely. The other problem is the Einstellung effect, which is if you think you have the idea already, it will block you from coming up with other options. So if you focus too hard on the first idea that comes to mind, you will disallow the possible other options that float around in your head. So keeping in mind, you want to be more diffuse about things rather than focused about things. So Zen cones are trying to teach you something. They, without clearly telling you what they're trying to teach you, they're trying to teach you something. Something to keep in mind is that these were isolated monks. Lots to keep in mind, I'm sorry. Isolated monks. They would live in a monastery. They were pranksters, they were tricksters, they were jokers. They were like, you know, you have menial daily tasks like sweeping and collecting the water and stuff like that. And everyone does the same thing every day, and you meditate for hours every day. Everyone does the same thing every day. So occasionally they would play tricks on each other, and they would make puns on each other, and they would be kind of funny about things. Because that's how you make life fun. That's the context in which cones developed. Alright. So hold on to all that. A brief word into Taoism. So Taoism is the concept that Zen Buddhism chases after. And Taoism translates as the way. And there's lots said about Taoism, but essentially anything that you can use to describe the way is not the way. So you have to be careful of any description, because any description of the thing is not actually the thing. So even the word Tao is not Taoism. And they like make jokes about it, and they like they confuse themselves about how Taoism is not really Taoism, and there's lots there. But I like the translation the way, because we have this in English, it makes sense, this broad, there is some sort of pathway that you're travelling down, without really, like, if you call it the way, then it's not really the thing. But having said that, it's the way. So sometimes a Zen cone will come with a 4-line poem. and it has a structure. The first line will tell you something, the second line will tell you a bit more about that thing, the third line will suggest a new concept, and then the fourth line will tie the first three together. So if you encounter a poem, that's the structure of the poem. So for example, maybe not yet. We'll come back to that one. Cones often talk about the subject and object relationship. So there's a set of water cones, there's a set of like animal cones, there's a set of person cones and thing cones, and they, in order to solve them, you kind of have to put yourself in the position of the members of that are engaging in the cone, and then think about being in that position and the action. So the first thing you need to look at is look for a thing that is mentioned. The next thing is to look for an action that is mentioned, and the third thing is to look for a holy actor or a holy voice that tells you things or states things. Or
you need to look for those things when solving a cone.
Three parts.
A cone's supposed to be solvable. Is that like?
Yes.
There's actually supposed to be like a riddly answer.
There's usually an answer, and it's usually not words. I'll get to examples.
Okay.
We'll definitely get to examples. A thing, an action, and a holy voice that says, gives you instructions. And you want to produce a combination of the first and second, so a thing and an action, in order to solve that particular type of cone. So they will sound they might sound challenging or confusing or pointless. They're not designed for the me to solve. They're designed to be found by a non-thinking and naive childlike person. So like a 5-year-old would, like, you'd ask them the question and they would just obviously answer it like this. So keep that in mind while keeping all the other bits and pieces of all, like, the mindset of solving a cone. They're based on three assumptions. The world is simple and nothing else but everyday activities. Theory or concept are of no use. And you, the actor, is identical with everything. So, as an example, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And you've probably heard this, you've probably heard the parodies of it. Yeah, very cute. So what they want you to do in this cone is they want you to clap. And then they want you to take one hand away and do it with one hand. And then everyone together now, with one hand. So what you're listening for is the sound that you experience when you clap with one hand. And you're trying to... You kind of have to live and try the cone in order to understand what it feels like to clap with one hand. And there's this strange sense at the end of, like, this clap. There's something you're listening for, and there's a feeling that you get that there's no sound, sort of. And it's quite kind of undescribable. That's what it's trying to point at. So it's not trying to point at... Feels kind of odd.
The anti-clap sound.
Yeah, like, there's something there, but you can't really put words to describe it. So that's what a lot of the cones like to do. They like to give you that weird feeling of like, I did the thing, but there's nothing there. And it doesn't help that they're all cryptic and they don't really try and explain themselves, but that's what they try and do. So the answer really is quite simple. You know, the answer is to go like this, to think and feel what it's like to clap with one hand. So yeah, the circle. I mentioned the circle. All right, time for some examples. A cup of tea. Nan In, a Japanese master during the Meiji era, received a university professor who came to inquire about Zen. Nan In served tea. He poured his visitor's cup full and then kept on pouring. The professor watched the overflow until he could no longer restrain himself. It is overfull, no more will go in. Like this cup, Nan In said, you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup? So obviously the point of this is, it's clear, you know, if you don't empty your cup, you'll never really understand or interpret the wonderful Zen. So that's kind of like level one, you know, shut up and listen. You know, it makes sense, right? Simple. But then there's a level within that, which is the experience of actually shutting up and listening, which they're trying to get you to imagine doing and imagine what it's like to actually empty your cup in order to learn, in order to take more in. So if you can imagine for a moment what it is like to be a full cup of tea and to empty your cup a bit in order to take more information in, that's the feeling that they're trying to give you in this cone. I mean, there's more to it. You could potentially imagine yourself the teacher trying to teach someone when they're a full cup, or you could imagine yourself being the professor full of speculations and needing to empty a bit. So that's very interesting. Some very interesting experiences that they're trying to poke at to get you to feel. So the next one. So how do we feel about that? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That there's a strange feeling and experience that they're trying to give you.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. One day, Chao Chu fell down in the snow and called out, "Help me up! Help me up!" A monk came and lay down beside him. Chao Chu got up and went away. in context, they're kind of pranksters and jokesters. Like, you know, he's fallen over and yelled, "Help me up! Help me up!" And the other guy's like, you know, obviously come to demonstrate that you don't need help to get up. Or maybe something else. Does someone else want to give an interpretation of what they think is happening?
The level of up is a societal standard based on
that. Sure, totally. And the experience of lying on the ground kind of demonstrates that you don't need help to be gotten getting up.
You also don't need to get up.
Yeah, you also don't need to get up.
Yeah.
That's right. So hopefully imparting the experience of, I don't know what that
is. Well, there could be some conserved quantity of get-upness, and you basically need someone to lie down and it's out, you know?
Right, sure, totally. Many, many options. So kind of fun, kind of like fits in context of them being pranksters. So one day, Manjushri stood outside the gate. The Buddha called to him, "Manjushri, Manjushri, why do you not enter?" And Manjushri replied, I do not see myself as outside. Why enter?" So Taoism has a belief that everything is already enlightened. In with Chao Chu, he was reminded that he doesn't need help getting up because no one can force you to be enlightened without you wanting to be enlightened. You need to help yourself. Similarly, if you're not outside, you don't need to enter very comfortably. There's another koan which says,
just waiting out there though, like, yeah, outside the gate until someone came so you could have that
line. Maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
You gotta go.
Alright, thank you.
Right.
See you guys.
See ya.
See ya. Guys, if you don't mind just tossing in the door for the whole time.
Mm. So yeah, maybe he was waiting outside. Maybe you've got to imagine yourself being Manjushri, hanging outside and, you know, waiting for someone to tell him to enter just so he can, like, entrap them with the, "I don't need to enter because I'm not outside," little experience.
Thanks, guys.
Which is, I guess, a fun one to imagine. So, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Which is to say that enlightenment looks the same before and after. You still chop wood and carry water, but you are with a sense of enlightenment carrying throughout your life. Unless there's, you want to, does someone want to mention anything else they see in that?
Well, that it's an internal thing, that it's what's going on in your head. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, it's the way you approach something, it's not what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, life goes on as well. Yeah.
But also, like, your way you're interpreting other people and other things and their actions is what you don't actually know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there's a couple of comments about whether a dog has achieved enlightenment, sort of thing. Is the dog enlightened? And the teacher responds, moo, which I think it translates as no, or no, or like...
Wolf.
Woof. It translates as woof. And that itself is a Zen cone. And the experience that they try and impart there is, imagine you were a dog, and someone asks you, have you achieved, you're in the experience of being a dog, and someone asks you, have you achieved enlightenment? And what do? You say, woof. Gosho said, when you meet a man of the way on the road, greet him not with words nor with silence. Tell me, how will you greet him?
Euclid play
instruments or a
wand
or something?
With a knife?
Yeah,
take his
sure.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was that? Not with words, not with silence.
Mm-hmm.
You wave at them.
Yeah, totally.
Do that high-five thing where you high-five on top and then you go down.
Oh,
yeah. That's how I feel like it,
though. That's how I do it. So, I guess, imparting the feeling of the high-five, the double high-five.
Right, it's the wheel, you see.
Yeah, you know, they're trying to shove you into that experience of doing the high-five. I guess. Or the desire to greet someone, maybe. So here's one that I don't quite get. Perfectly. But here goes. As the roof was leaking, a Zen master told two monks to bring something to catch the water. One brought a tub, the other a basket. The first was severely reprimanded, the second highly praised. So, I think this is something to do with they're asked to catch the water. Bring something to catch the water. And the instruction to bring something to catch the water is not an instruction to go bring a tub so we can use the water. It's just to catch the water. Obviously, being pranksters, the one guy was like, I'm going to bring a basket. But
could it be a basket of something that could use the water, though?
I suspect it was more like a basket purposely has holes in it. You were catching the water, but some of it gets out anyway, sort of thing. Well, you don't have to hold the water to catch it. But I don't quite... It's not quite obvious to me what the purpose is.
Well, that's interesting. It's kind of like the thing of you don't have to attend every argument you're invited to.
Mm-hmm.
You can catch it and then let it go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. The old story about the lawyer instructing his client how to answer questions. He says, do you know what time it is? And the only correct answer is yes. You know, as soon as you volunteer more information than they've asked for, you're giving up something you didn't have to.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm not... There's something there with the baskets and the tubs, but I don't quite have it. But
meditate on it for a year and a half.
Yeah, clearly. Every day for an hour, and it'll like suddenly become known to me.
Don't focus too hard on it. You might miss it.
We get to not think about it for a year and a half.
I see. Sam's got it.
Let it drip through.
A monk asked Master Hario, what is the way? Hario said, an open-eyed man falling into the well.
Sorry, again, what?
An open-eyed man falling into the well.
Could have just been a hot day.
Could have been just been a hot day. So I suspect it's something along the lines of the way is so blinding and yet so obvious. Like even with open eyes, you have to fall down a well to find it, sort of.
You couldn't avoid it even if you were trying to.
Yeah.
Through the process of living or doing it.
Yeah. Bit of a...
I see it as like letting yourself fall in the well, right? Like, it's like, no, this is
the
way I get it.
The glass thing.
Hmm?
Dropping the glasses.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's like, yeah, letting the experience you have down the well be the experience that you have, not trying to fight that.
Not trying to make anything else other than what it is.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate that there are different interpretations, and it's good to do this with a room full of people who can kind of maybe see a little bit different.
I think the most useful one is whichever one is most useful for you.
Yes. Well, and ideally having a Zen Buddhist master impart, say, this is the one you need, to work out in order to understand everything.
Would they say that though? Or would they just give you another cone?
They would push you down a well.
No. So it's kind of known that they give you a cone to focus on until you solve it.
By using the methods of not focusing and focusing and everything else, then you would and allow all the different versions to come through as you evolve to see them.
The question is, are they good at doing that? And honestly, the process of causing people to have enlightenment is to make them meditate on things for years at a time. So, I don't know. I think there are better methods of imparting the ideas, but maybe I'm also missing things.
It does sound kind of inefficient.
Yeah, I don't know. They settled on it as, like, this is the way to enlightenment.
Well, isn't the thing is, like, Master, how long will it take me to reach enlightenment? Because Master, he goes, for you... 1 year. Because, Master, no, I'm in a hurry. I don't have any time. For you,
2 years.
Years.
There is a cone about that. I'll get to it. It's further down. A monk saw a turtle in the garden of Daisu's monastery and asked the teacher, "All beings cover their bones with flesh and skin. Why does this being cover its flesh with skin and bones? Flesh and skin with bones." Master Daisu took off one of his sandals and covered the turtle with it. So I don't know. It's a bit like it's just the whole thing is a joke. And it's a bit like
there's no turtle.
Maybe there's no turtle.
Maybe it's because the bones are naked.
Yeah, maybe the turtle needed to be wearing clothing. Maybe it's about what you see. You see the clothing on the thing rather than no.
Yeah, I don't see it any of those ways. To me, it's that all beings cover themselves like this. Well, this turtle's now covered in a thong. You know, like, why do you ask this question about the things that you see right in front of you? It's not important. Right? Like, the reason why it's covered in a thong is because I put it there. So, you know.
Yeah, because the thing is not the thing.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
Why does the turtle have a shell on it? Because it's in a shell.
Because it's got a thong on it, that's why.
Yeah.
And its tail's all the way down.
I thought once about gravity. Once said, like, what is gravity? Oh, it's the thing that makes stuff fall down. Okay, why does it fall down? Oh, because of gravity. But okay, that's helpful.
Doesn't answer the question.
Two monks were arguing about the temple flag waving in the wind. One said, the flag moves. The other said, the wind moves. They argued back and forth but could not agree. Huneng, the sixth patriarch, said, "Gentlemen, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the wind that moves, it is your mind that moves." The two monks were struck with awe. Go.
Tell me to?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the point is that ultimately it's your perception of the flag that is... Well, I mean, it's like you can kind of describe... If you're trying to talk about causes of things, right, it's sort of arbitrary where you start and stop. You could say the flag is moving because of the wind. You could say the wind is moving because of the air pressure. You could say the air pressure is moving because of the heat of the sun on a rotating body. You could, you know, some point you've got to stop somewhere, so why not stop at it moves because you think it's moving.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of the mind imposes its form onto the world.
Mm. Yeah. Math and territory.
I liked the... what I thought it meant, or my interpretation of it was that the fact that they were disagreeing on the same thing means that the difference was in their minds and not in the actual thing.
That's cute. I like that too.
Yeah.
I like this one. This one's funny. Oh, there is the one-fingered enlightenment one, but that's a different one. Gesan was sitting at the bedside of Tekisu 3 days before his teacher's passing. Tekisu had already chosen him as his successor. A temple recently had burned, and Gesan was busy rebuilding the structure. Tekisu asked him, "What are you going to do when the temple is rebuilt?" "When your sickness is over, we want you to speak there," said Gesan. "Suppose I do not live until then." "Then we will get someone else," replied Gesan. "Suppose you cannot find anyone," continued Tekisu. Gesan answered loudly, "Don't ask such foolish questions, just go to sleep." So I think with this one, you have to take each statement out of context. So, "suppose you cannot find anyone" is like, but what if it was the apocalypse? So, with that, in response to that, the correct answer is, don't be ridiculous. And suppose, what will you do if I'm not there? Well, we'll get someone else. Like, obviously. But
if I'm not there, it's not my problem.
Well, if I'm not there, then you'll obviously have to get someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you can't find someone else, well, that would imply apocalypse.
Yes.
Just go to sleep. Let's skip that one. That one, because it's really long. The most valuable thing in the world. Zozan, a Chinese Zen master, was asked by a student, "What is the most valuable thing in the world?" The master replied, "The head of a dead cat." "Why is the head of a dead cat the most valuable thing in the world?" inquired the student. Zozan replied, "Because no one can name its price." So to me, teachers are jerks. And just because something is priceless doesn't mean it's it's most valuable.
That's the difference between price and value.
So I think this is potentially like a translation thingo, and the words might be closer.
It'd be interesting to know what it's like in the original language, because priceless in English obviously has that duality.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I suspect that it has similar. Or they've purposely been done like that.
It'd actually be interesting to find out about that, because the whole like price value confusion or maybe deliberate conflation is kind of like an important cultural thing, I think, in a lot of.
Well, I mean, so there's value and there's worth.
Well, sure.
Right. So something that is worth like nothing, like a head of dead cat, has no price.
Right. Yeah. I'm saying that confusion. I could see either of those turning out to be true. Either that there are some cultures where there's no, you know, where there are distinct words for those two things and they're never confused, or I could see it going the other way, where it's like, you know, just because of the nature of people, you always end up with this idea that, instead of the word for like dear as in important and dear as in, you know, valuable monetarily or like costly, that shows up in a lot of languages. They have the same word for both, which is a kind of curious thing, because I thought that was something just weird about it.
It's cool. I note that in Chinese, expensive is the same as honorable.
Yeah, right.
As in, you might address one to someone by saying, "Your honorableness, Mr. Redelman," but it's the same as saying, "Your expensiveness, Mr. Redelman."
Yeah.
Your
exquisiteness, sort of.
Yeah, like, you know, your similarity to a very nice, you know, sculpture or something like that.
Zen Master Unman said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put your robes on at the sound of a bell?"
Was that last sentence, "Why do you put your roofs?"
Robes on at the sound of a bell.
You don't have that in the Chinese, do you? Just the English.
No. You could probably find them in Chinese pretty easily. I mean, there's a set of them called The Gateless Gate, because that's the name of the book. And it's about, obviously, walking through a gate when there is no gate. Which is another metaphor for what enlightenment is meant to be like. Just like the circle, just like all of these things, what is like falling down a well. All trying to point at the same thing. It's like you begin to appreciate all of these converging metaphors, like gateless gate, the falling down a well, like maybe, like if that's all they're pointing at, enlightenment is so much closer than I thought it was, than this other mysterious thing.
For you, 10 years.
So I included kind of more extra cones at the end, just in case I had time. Mark asked Zhao Zhu to teach him. Zhao Zhu asked, "Have you eaten your meal?" The monk replied, "Yes, I have." "Then go wash your bowl," said Zhao Zhu. At that moment, the monk was enlightened.
Learned how to be a good housemate.
Huh? Clearly.
I'm kind of enlightened.
Yeah. I mean, I guess just go about your day once you have a Once you have achieved your enlightenment, you go about your day.
It's quite the same as the other one. Before enlightenment, after enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's about returning it to its state, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
As well.
Completing
if you copy. Use a thing, you return it back to how it was.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that instructing someone to then go and wash their bowl is giving an instruction. Please teach me. Okay, I'll teach you to wash your bowl. You know.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of things to it. I don't know quite which one you're meant to settle on, perhaps, or if there is one. So there is one thing I didn't mention. I mean, it comes with not being able to describe Taoism. You're also not able to describe what is Buddha, what is the thing. So when asking what is Buddha, the answer is really nothing is or everything is. So a monk asked Tozan, when he was weighing some flax, what is Buddha? Tozan said, this flax weighs 3 pounds. Maybe a hint that it is just plain dead obvious. Or such a question is not a real question.
Does everyone know the like get out of the car metaphor?
Yeah. Alrighty.
What is the
get out of the car?
In our society we spend our entire lives in cars, a man drives up to the wise man who is outside of the car and says, wise man, I've driven all of the roads of this country.
All the highways,
Yeah, but I would like to get to the top of that mountain. And the wise man said, oh, that's very simple. You just need to get out of the car and walk.
Tell me, which button on the console do I press to do the get out of the car?
Yeah. And the
which street
says,
do I drive down to get out of the car?
And the man gets frustrated and says, why are you being so cryptic? And the wise man said, it's the simplest thing you'll ever do. You just have to get out of the car. And eventually goes off and this, yeah. But like the idea is that enlightenment is just like getting out of the car. And if you try and think about it, it's like, which button on the console do I push? What do I do? Where do I need to go? What's my schedule going to be when I achieve enlightenment? Then, yeah.
Okay.
If that helps. I'm not explaining it very well.
So it was a Scott Alexander post. Let's get out.
More concrete examples.
Yeah.
You want to know which button to push?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of all part of it. So hopefully a glimpse at the unknown, weird and confusing thingamajig.
Also, I looked up the word price.
Yeah.
So the first translation that comes up from English into Chinese has two meanings, price and value.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the Chinese has similar, and there's a lot of things that are like
but
that.
What about priceless?
We shall see.
More incapable?
Because price I wasn't so interested in, but priceless is like means the two opposite things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, say something is priceless would literally mean that you could, two parties could never exchange a dollar value to swap for it, which is a strange concept, you know. You could say, well, I will not sell this for any amount. Well, that's a different concept, you know. But to say something is priceless, I don't like that idea.
Well, it's a deliberate wordplay, but, like, they were comedians and tricksters. Like, they were pulling pranks on each other like tubs and baskets all the time.
Yeah, just say what you mean.
No, the point is to purposely obfuscate and confuse each other. That's part of the fun. you've got a long way to go to get to enlightenment.
Yeah.
See, it's interesting.
Like
on one hand,
car.
You've got, like, the Eastern monks, and they're all like, let's just play jokes on everyone. And then you've got the Western monks, and they're like, let's just get drunk all the time.
Makes sense. They figured out the meaning of life.
At least someone has.
The priceless seems to be the same as in English. It's amazing. Most languages have this thing that make and do and are the same word, unlike English.
Yeah.
But Chinese has that too, but... Yeah, priceless seems to be without price, but also meaning incredibly valuable.
And I think it's really interesting is in some languages, say like in French, the verb for miss, the subject and object are the other way around than in English. So, which sounds kind of crazy, right? But like basically, you can kind of think of it as like they have a separate verb that means you make me miss you, and that's what the verb means.
To be missed or to.
But, so it's like, you know, you wouldn't say like I miss you. You'd say you've caused me to miss you. Like that's what you've done, which sounds sort of like loopy, right? Until you realize we have a bunch of words for that for different emotions, like. To say you anger someone is like, you know, you forced me to be angry at you, but you're the subject of this. I didn't do it, you did it.
Mm.
But it's like, you know, it's weird that you can have these sort of like totally opposite renderings of the same emotional thing depending on who's meant to be in charge.
I find those phrases really weird, like the whole I miss you thing. It's like, I don't miss you, but like I'll say the phrase because it's a societal thing you're supposed to say to make people feel good.
Right.
But it is like, it's just it's a template.
Right.
Like, I feel quite relieved hearing that. I very rarely miss people.
Yeah. I know a lot of people that don't. Like, I may feel a longing to spend time with someone, but if someone's like, I have a friend who, like, well, we were in a group of us we were away on a holiday and it was like the last day. He's like, oh, I'm so sad. Like, I'm going to miss you. I'm like, we're still here. Like, you're missing me while I'm already here.
I will eventually miss you, and that is terrible.
But, like, let's enjoy it now while we're all here.
It's interesting because when you were talking about the first thing, I could relate to that. Like, I've never been like, oh, I missed this particular person. But at the same time, I completely understand what that guy was saying. In the moment, you're like, well, it's not even loss aversion. It's kind of like, in the moment, you're like, this moment's so good that all I can think about is that it's going to end.
But that's silly.
You're sure about it.
Nobody ever said
that.
I mean, people are different. I definitely feel that at times. But yeah, people are very different in that regard.
Yeah.
You know, some people do just don't feel certain things, and some people do.
I'd rather just like enjoy it.
I think everybody would rather enjoy it.
Anyway, I'm enjoying this conversation. I'd love to continue with some food.
One more? Yes. Hoshin, who. Alright, now I have to start at the top. Zen Master Hoshin lived in China many years. Then he returned to the northeastern part of Japan where he taught his disciples. When he was getting very old, he told them a story he had heard in China. One year on the 25th of December, Tokufu, who was very old, said to his disciples, "I'm not going to be alive next year, so you fellows should treat me well this year." The pupils thought he was joking, but since he was a great how the teacher, each of them in turn treated him to a feast on succeeding days of the departing year. On the eve of the new year, Tofu concluded, "You have been good to me. I shall leave tomorrow afternoon when the snow has stopped." The disciples laughed, thinking he was aging and talking nonsense, since the night was clear and without snow. But at midnight, the snow began to fall, and the next day they did not find their teacher about. They went to the meditation hall, and there he had passed on. Hoshin, who related this story, told his disciples, "It is not necessary for a Zen master to predict his passing, but if he really wishes to do so, he can." "Can you?" someone asked. "Yes," answered Hoshin. "I will show you what I can do 7 days from now." None of the disciples believed him, and most of them had even forgotten the conversation when Hoshin called them together. "7 days ago," he remarked, "I said I was going to leave you. It is customary to write a farewell poem, but I am neither a poet nor a calligrapher. Let one of you inscribe my last words." His followers thought he was joking, but one of them started to write. "Are you ready?" Hoshin asked. "Yes, sir," replied the writer. Then Hoshin dictated, "I came from brilliancy and returned to brilliancy. What is this?" This poem was one line short of the customary four, so the disciple said, "Master, we are one line short." Hoshin, with the roar of a conquering lion, shouted, "Ka!" and was gone.
Oh,
my gosh. So, I said quite early on, the four-line poem. So the first line and second line talk about something. The third line brings something new up, and the fourth line ties it all together. So, "I came from brilliancy and returned to brilliancy. What is this? Master, we are one line short."
Well, somehow I'm reminded of Emperor Vespasian's last words. Has anybody heard that one?
No.
"Oh dear, I fear I am becoming a god."
So that was Zen Cones. Hopefully you can think a little differently about being inside a Zen Cone and what it's like to clap with one hand or reverse kind of anything.
I was suddenly we find them.